Howdy. Thanks for listening to Let the Movie Speak. Before we get started, we'd like to ask a favor of you.
It's a simple favor. If you could just rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen, that might help other ears get into our ecosystem here and hear another episode. Anyway, enjoy the show.
This week on Let the Movie Speak, we begin our descent into time, time travel movies with 1960s, The Time Machine.
Well, if you couldn't tell from the groovy theme music, we are in a miniseries, Justin.
And we sure is.
Yeah, it's, oh man, I was jamming over here to that song.
You and me both, my friend. Yeah. I was dancing in the streets.
A little bit. You went out to the streets to dance and then you came.
I went out. These headphones stretch a long way and a dancer dances, my friend.
That's what Pavarotti always says. A dancer dances.
Jazz hands.
Yeah, all of it. Anyway, we are here. We are post-40s. We are post our second season award show, The Golden Spuds. We hope you enjoyed all of that new content. If you did, share something on social media. Tell someone, hey, this was a good episode. We really enjoyed these two crazy people talking about potato awards, among other things. But now
it's
we're
normal. Totally normal.
Totally normal. Every podcast does it, right? That's what I've heard. Anyway, tonight we are starting an endeavor into time and space, a mini series that we've constructed all around some kind of eccentrically chosen time travel movies. And Justin, I believe I threw this first one into consideration. It just seemed like it made sense because we started looking around and there's all kinds of different time travel movies. They've been making time travel movies since almost movies were talking, like our show focuses on. And I was like, hey, let's start with the thing that kind of kicked the whole pop culture idea of time travel off, which is an adaptation of H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, a novella. And so we have the original feature from 1960 tonight. That's our feature presentation or something. And Justin, are you a little bit more warm? Are you warming up to the idea of this time travel series since last we spoke of it?
I am. You know, you just kind of have to embrace, there's a phrase in the military, embrace the suck. I don't know that it's that extreme in this case, but you do just, you know, there's a lot of goofiness, especially in this subgenre, right?
And
that's fine. There's a place for goofiness. It doesn't all have to be bicycle thieves. Thank goodness, because I would have been dead.
Yeah.
I am excited about it, and I think we're going to have some fun, hopefully, talking about The Time Machine tonight, because it's a movie that just lends itself to what the kids call ridicule.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we're going to be like these schoolyard bullies pushing this movie around. Like, hey, where's your lunch money, time machine?
You think you're going to time travel? Take this.
Yeah. You are the most prepubescent bully I've ever heard in my life.
Well, yeah, I was just going back to childhood trauma, you know.
Okay.
Third grade. And
you had a soprano bully.
Jimmy Winks a Lot. Jimmy Winks a Lot was a real jerk.
Oh,
kids.
Man. It's good. It's really good to take a break from heavy post-war 40s movies, which are, you know, there was some great stuff in that last series.
Oh,
but this is just a breath, you know, between the 40s and the 50s, which, you know, you go from the 40s mid World War II, really, to post-World War II into the 50s, which we're going to get into next, which is Cold War era, not exactly like, you know, kicks and giggles all the way through.
Right.
We're going to get into The Time Machine very soon here, but before we do that, we're going to tell you a little bit about what we watched this week. Justin, if I'm not mistaken, I think you have a movie of a similar vintage to speak of for you. What did we watch this week?
I do. I watched 1967's Camelot,
yes,
which is a Arthurian musical movie, which is adapted actually from a play from 1960, same year as our movie tonight. See that little tie in there?
Yeah.
It's all coming together, folks.
Every thread connects. That's right.
I don't know that Camelot quite came together. But now, in all fairness, so my esteemed partner in life, my wife, Kelsey, is a huge Arthurian fan.
Yes, I've heard tell of her love of Arthurian legends.
The tales are true. And she, you know, does like to see a lot of these adaptations and, you know, figure out, you know, I don't know, man. It's like, I guess it's like superhero movies before Marvel came out. There's a lot more misses than hits, right?
Sure.
Or like Stephen King adaptations.
Yep.
So it's kind of the same from the little I've seen so far, at least, of Arthurian stuff. So in all fairness to this movie, I watched the first 15 minutes and went, this looks stupid, which may not have been totally fair. But there was something about King Arthur sitting in a tree singing about being like scared of marrying Guinevere. I was just like, I'm not getting this. I'm not feeling it. But then, you know, my wife watched more of it, and she said, you know, would you come back and at least finish it with me? I said, okay, let's do that. So I think I watched about the last hour or so, and it was certainly better. And it was strange because it's kind of really campy at times.
Right.
Like I just mentioned, Arthur sitting in a tree, like, I don't know if I can marry Guinevere.
And he's clearly Italian in this adaptation.
Right. He's throwing a pizza pie.
And he eats a bunch of meatballs, and then the next thing happens.
But there is an Italian in here. Franco Nero plays Lancelot.
Oh,
which,
wow.
I think I mean, honestly, it's not... That's not bad in and of itself, I think. But for it's super 60s.
Yeah.
He wears this low cut, like Burt Reynolds. Like Burt Reynolds with the chain and Smokey and the Bandit.
Oh, yeah.
He's kind of doing the same thing, but in the like 900 AD realm. And so it's a musical, right? And so Franco Nero, like you hear him talk and he has this French accent, which, you know, I mean, how hard is that? But then he goes to sing, and it's like, Kelsey's like, I'm not sure I liked that his voice dropped like four octaves when he sung. And I was like, there's no way that's Franco Nero. I've heard Franco Nero speak, and that's not his voice.
It's not possible.
And sure enough, no, it's not. Yeah, thank goodness, you know, like, hey, I'm Lancelot, guys. Is kind of what we got, like a bullfrog came out. And it turns out his music singing was all ixnayed and replaced with ADR.
Bicycle thieves style. Yes.
Yeah, it's bad. That's not good. Editing is really strange in this movie. You would almost think that people like purposefully made continuity errors like for a laugh, but no, I guess that's just like they forgot to shoot a second take or something, or the cameraman fell asleep. I don't know what happened. But to be totally fair to this movie, from what I've seen of it anyway, it's quite a movie review, huh? I've seen half of the movie. Here you go. Here's my impression.
That's why they come to us, Justin.
That's why we make the big bucks.
Those informed folks. Takes, yes.
You know, it does have something to say, you know. And,
right.
And I think Arthurian legend at its core really does have a lot to say that is good.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie does try to say some of those things. I think some things, from what I saw anyway, hit a little harder than others. All in all, definitely worth it if you're an Arthurian nerd. I can't see somebody that's really into that being like, no, Camelot is beneath me. You know, because it really does. I think they do, for better and for worse, the filmmakers did understand what was important, I think, for some of these characters, like what makes them tick. And, you know, is the crux, or the like the marrow. Oh, gosh, that sounds really pretentious. But, you know, is like the meat of this story really about like the illicit affair between Lancelot and Guinevere, or is it about like how a kingdom is divided and about Arthur's humanity? And, you know, I mean, so it does tackle, I think, the right themes and in some of the right ways, but definitely not in a perfect way. However, Travis, like tonight's movie, it also received a bunch of Academy Award nominations.
Yeah.
Maybe some of that's just not aging well, you know, like this movie. But before I get ahead of myself, what did you watch this week?
So I watched something utterly different than that. But that you sold me on it when you said he was singing in a tree. So I'm there. I'm there for all 3 hours of Camelot. No, I rewatched this week something that I had seen in theaters. I'm a huge Stephen King fan. He's one of my favorite authors, and there's just so much Stephen King adaptation work out there. Some of it's great, you know. Some of it's really bad, and it's just this huge breadth of, like, if you want to get into, if you're at all, interested in stuff that's horror or horror adjacent. He's such a prolific author, and for so many years that his IP is like almost invaluable at this point. So the other cool thing about Stephen King is he's not afraid to like give up rights and let people run with things. And so this is a really interesting story. Dr. Sleep is a novel that was written by Stephen King in 2013, which is a sequel to a book he wrote way back in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken, called The Shining, which everybody's heard of because there's, you know, a lot of critical acclaim for the novel. It's supposed to be one of his greatest works. And there's this Stanley Kubrick movie from 1980 called The Shining, which is, it's called by many the greatest horror film of all time. It's, you know, it's classic Kubrick. It's got that vintage Jack Nicholson performance. And it's, you know, no shots fired at The Shining here. I love the book. I like the movie in its own right. However, when that movie came out, Stephen King hated it. And it's one of the few adaptations that have been made of his work that he has just vehemently said, this is not my story. Kubrick didn't get it, you know, yada, yada, yada. You can Google the history there if you're interested. But what's really interesting about Dr. Sleep is he wrote a direct sequel to his book, The Shining, many, many years later. And I've read it. It's not great. I love Stephen King, but they're not all hits. Some of them are misses. You know, you can't write that much and have it all be gold. Justin, let me just, I'll test the waters with you, because I don't know that you're a huge Stephen King fan, but you've read a bit. Yeah. Mostly at my, I've joshed you into reading, I think, a book or two. This book is about an older Danny Torrance, which is the kid in The Shining. And it really involves, I won't sugarcoat it, a group of gypsy vampires who suck the steam, which is the soul, out of other people in the world who have The Shining. Does that sound like it has potential to you?
No.
Yeah. It's goofy. It's totally off the wall. The book is kind of long, and a lot of it is like astral projection stuff with characters, you know, like moving across space and time. It's just a clunky read. It doesn't do many things well, and it certainly doesn't live up to The Shining, the original novel, or the great Stanley Kubrick film. Now, the book, not good in my opinion. I don't think a ton of people love this book. But here's the thing. The movie that I watched, Dr. Sleep, is from 2019, just a couple years ago, and it's directed by a guy named Mike Flanagan, who has proved himself in the sort of horror cinema world as a really sharp, competent director. And he tends to tackle projects that are seemingly very difficult. The first Stephen King adaptation he did was of a book called Gerald's Game, which is a...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, single location, kind of a woman trapped story. And if you told me, like, I'm going to pick a Stephen King property to adapt, oh, it's a woman stuck in one place the whole time, I would be like, don't make a movie out of that. That's a terrible idea. It's great. Like, as an adaptation, it's great. As a standalone piece of film, it's so well done. And so when I heard he was doing Dr. Sleep, I was like, that's a terrible book. If anyone can do it, he might be the guy. And what's really fascinating about this movie is it is, at one time and another time, it is a direct sequel to Stephen King's novel, just like the book. And it is a direct sequel to Stanley Kubrick's movie, which is not, you know, Stephen King's stamp of approval. So it manages to bring you into the cinematic world of Kubrick's The Shining while really adapting Stephen King's clunky novel in a way that is way more successful than it should be. And I rewatched the movie because it came out with a director's cut, and I'd seen the theatrical cut, really liked it, and heard things about the director's cut that were interesting. First being, it's longer. It's like, it's almost 3 hours long. The movie was two and change. But it also has chapter segments, sort of, you know, novel style. And I have to say, like, not every director's cut is the better version for me. I mean, Blade Runner comes to mind, and there's just like, you know, four different versions, and they're all just a little bit different, and they all bring something else to the table. But this is just is so much better, because I think Mike Flanagan gets Stephen King. He understands the subtextual stuff in the head of the characters that really matters, that that brings all the human qualities to the surface, and not make it just about set pieces or monsters or spiritual horror. He understands the person-to-person conflict that makes the best Stephen King writing really compelling. And yet he resuscitates a book that is not really worth it, in my opinion. So you've got Ewan McGregor in the lead, and a kind of goofy story on the page that he just massages into working really well. It's really dark. It's definitely scary, but more than anything, the human drama at the center puts, you know, Ewan McGregor's Danny Torrance as sort of our new Jack Torrance. And I won't get into spoilers, but I will say he makes some decisions, Justin, that I think even if this isn't your favorite movie ever, you would really appreciate, where he could have taken a person in a scene that is playing a classic character, wink, wink, that we all know from the original film, and CGI'd the face on, kind of a thing, right? Like, they could have used that effect. And instead, you know what he does? He uses a new actor, and they just play the part. And
beautiful.
I just, there's moves like that in this movie that I just respect to the moon and back, that, you know, people who are so in love with the original IP would be like, oh, how could you not CGI Jack Nicholson's face, you know, here or whatever?
Because it looked terrible, right? Everyone, that's why.
And Mike Flanagan is so confident that, like, he uses new actors, you know, recast parts, but he also is insane in that they rebuilt the Overlook Hotel and shot some footage that looks like it's just out of the original movie. So I would just say, if you're at all interested in Stephen King, if you want to see a really wild project just come together against all odds, and just see Mike Flanagan, in my opinion, hit it out of the park again, check out Dr. Sleep. It's spooky. It's really well done. And if you can, catch the director's cut, which I watched on HBO Max. Now, let's get into something that is another, not a novel adaptation, but a novella adaptation. Something that we can really wrap our minds around in the time travel universe, because it's called The Time Machine, for goodness sakes. In a segment, which is an intro to the film, which you're used to hearing us do, we're going to give some context and some background. But in this case, because we are traveling through time, this section is called Getting Jiggy with the Jiggy Watts.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts!
How many times have we been here?
Would you believe me if I told you I was sent here from the future?
I want to know when and where you sent him.
What, you think I keep, like, a logbook?
Target vector, July 16, 1969.
So, Justin, I don't have a ton of, like, contextual information, because it's just not that there's no, like, production hell story behind this. This is a This is a big studio picture. It's directed by George Pal, who did a bunch of shorts before this, and then this is his second feature-length movie, and it also came near the end of his career. So this is one of his feature-length films. He did Tom Thumb, which was a feature-length before this, I think with a British studio as well, if I'm not mistaken. And it's written by David Duncan, who, among other things, he wrote an episode of The Outer Limits, the original 60s series, which makes total sense, Justin, I think. Because this feels like a feature-length version of an Outer Limits story in a lot of ways. And what's the difference, right? Like, we love The Twilight Zone here on Let the Movie Speak, both of us. And there's a difference between The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits for me. And I've seen a lot more of The Twilight Zone, all of it, multiple times through. I've seen a fair amount of The Outer Limits, but it's just, it's kind of a cheap knockoff. You know what I mean? Like, it's a little dumber, a little cheaper. Occasionally there's a good one, but it's, I don't know, Justin, what would you say the batting average of The Twilight Zone original series is? Like, good episode?
Oh gosh. It varies. I think you get 2 out of 4 or 3 out of 4.
Yeah,
in the season, I think. And in my opinion, that's because The Outer Limits is more interested in concept.
Yeah.
And I think The Twilight Zone is more interested in character.
Sure.
And so, and but like I said, 2 out of 4 or 3 out of 4. So they do err and they lose sight of that sometimes massively.
Yeah.
You know, overall, I think the Twilight Zone had a real knack when it was really good. And I think kind of why no one's been able to replicate it, it quite to the excellence that the original was anyway.
Yeah.
Is because they were like, okay, yeah, if we take this crazy sci-fi scenario, just take something totally bonkers or something really, really scary. Well, those things aren't really that interesting ultimately if we don't have people we can hold on to.
Sure.
And that make us feel the weight of those things.
Yeah.
I don't just feel the weight of the time machine because I see the character in this movie get into a machine and go to the future. I don't really understand it. And I think that's why this movie is, like you said, kind of like a Outer Limits-esque kind of thing, because it's not, you never really get to know him. And yeah. I think in the best Twilight Zone stuff, you do. You in 25 minutes,
yep.
You know those characters, and then you don't go to sleep.
Yeah. So we have a big studio picture, essentially. It's 1960. It's just, we've literally just landed in the 60s. And this thing is in, what do they call it? Not Technicolor,
Wasn't it? It was not Technicolor? Technoscope?
Metrocolor.
Oh.
Because it's all like studio-based, you know, proprietary color, yeah. You know.
I thought maybe that was like the Payless shoes version of Technicolor.
Yeah, it very well may be. But I think everybody at that time, just like with 3D, whenever it's tried to become a thing again, it's like, well, this is our 3D. This is their color. And, you know, this is a adaptation of H.G. Wells' novella, which, Justin, I'll speak on this real quickly because I believe you've actually read the novella. But I've read a couple H.G. Wells works and I just really loved both of them, War of the Worlds and The Invisible Man. And I will say, based on my watching of this movie, which we'll get into, he has a lot of, he's able to wrangle a lot of theme and interesting kind of meat on the bone, which is what we really look for on this show. In the novella form, which is, I don't feel like you see it all that often, right? You have some short story writers, and mostly people are, they're all shooting to write that great novel. H.G. Wells, what I love about his writing is it's very ambitious in concept, but he also doesn't overstay the welcome of what he's writing. So I would assume, not based on this movie, but based on my other readings of him, that I would probably really like the novella. Now you've actually read it, so you can give us some better comparison, maybe some preliminary comparison between what you got from the novella and what we got from this.
From this thing? Yeah. I think you're on the money, as the niños say. With H.G. Wells and, you know, what he does in, with his writing, the scope and the size and all that. The Time Machine is much in the same vein. It's less than 100 pages, if I recall. And yet it kind of birthed the time travel novel and movie. The time travel story as we know it is kind of his fault.
We'll call it his fault now. And that may prove itself to be more and more true as we work our way through this series.
Yeah. And, you know, for the novella is really interesting. I do think that the movie's quite a bit different. There's some serious deviations taken, I think, to, you know, here we are in 1960. Hollywood, at least, is not brave enough to make the, you know, there's no spaghetti westerns coming out of Hollywood, right? So kind of dark characters, ambiguity, gray. Yeah. This is not coming out of, generally speaking, 1960 America. I think by the end of the decade, that has changed quite a bit. Certainly, the kind of the cynicism and the kind of helplessness feeling of the original novella is not really replicated in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think to make it more palpable, which makes sense. I don't think anyone wants to see a movie where somebody goes so far into the future that there's just blackness. and
sounds
they're like,
hilarious.
I give up.
Yeah.
Let's go back. you know, so I guess I could save some of that for when we get into the time travel version of What's It Saying.
Yes.
But they are different, but if it's his fault that we have the time travel movie, I think it is the Time Machine 1960 movie's fault that we have just kind of, we accept time travel movies as maybe subpar.
Yeah.
It kind of set the bar pretty low, in my opinion.
Great. Let's get into it. We're going to review the movie. We're going to talk about characters, question mark, plot, theme, whatever's going on here in a section we call Lessons in Lightspeed.
Well, I mean, wormholes, black holes, Tipler cylinders.
So not like fantasy, but science fiction.
Where are we going in your time machine?
Okay, now, we gotta set this thing to the 15th.
Do not lose that time device, or you will be stuck.
How will I know if it works?
You'll either know, or you won't.
So much like the novella, we have a central character who is our inventor. And I believe in the novella, he's just referred to as the Traveler. And here he gets a name, and his name is H. George Wells, which is a really weird meta decision that H.G. Wells didn't make. But I believe I read somewhere that it was like a combination between, you know, oh, let's pay homage to H.G. Wells, and the director's name is George Powell. So it's like it's a combination, whatever. Anyway.
Ooh, high five, everybody.
Yeah, good job. This is headed up by a cast starring Rod Taylor, who is kind of a hunky, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed leading man. And Justin, I think I mentioned this to you in a text message. I was like, man, I know this guy's face. He's sort of a Roger Moore type. And I was like, I know this guy's face. And finally, I put my finger on it. He is in a Twilight Zone episode that I hold very near and dear to my heart called And When the Sky Was Opened. And he plays the Colonel Forbes, who's basically the central character until he isn't anymore, which is a great episode.
Yes, watch it. Stop now and watch it if you haven't.
It's so good. It's sort of peak Twilight Zone to me. And it stars him as an army colonel. This stars him as the inventor, the traveler, as it were. And the framing device of this movie, I would guess, matches the novel because it feels kind of H.G. Wells in its structure. We get this group of stuffy friends who are invited over for dinner, and they're like, oh, he's late. He's always late. And then he bursts in one of the very first scenes, and he's all tattered and, you know, he's got dirt all over him and he looks exhausted. And then he proceeds to tell the story of the movie. And that's bookended by flashing back to this scene at the end. But basically, we have Rod Taylor as the inventor. It's a very simple setup. He invents a time machine, right? And, you know, we've seen this before. If you've seen Back to the Future, if you've seen any movie of that ilk, it's that sort of normal setup. We have a time machine. Oh my gosh, my mind is blown. We can go through time. This is the first time we've seen that, right?
Right.
And what I find interesting about the setup, Justin, is the, and I don't know how much, you know, I have found that H.G. Wells in his writing is a little technical. He does bother to explain things. It doesn't ever come off as overly verbose or clunky in his writing because it's only 100 pages, give or take, right? So, but in this, it's like so simple. It's like, here's the miniature version. They don't even bother to explain how anything works, you know? They talk about the fourth dimension for a minute, and then it's like, whoa, the miniature's gone, right? The cigar man, and he's gone. So did you find anything in the setup to this as, I don't know, compelling?
Well, yeah, so I did find, not compelling, but I did find a couple things that made me go, one is that I think this is the movie that, quite honestly, it's been a few years since I read Wells the Time Machine, so while I do recall some specific details kind of vividly, I don't recall him going into a tremendous amount of detail about how he made time travel possible.
It might be the right choice. I mean, like, if you try to explain something so fantastical like that, it might be like, well, you should have just said it worked, so.
Right, but I think this movie does it even worse, where it's like, it's like, what is time travel? And they're like, what are the dimensions? And then one doctor's like, I'll show you. Look, I can go up and down. I can go side to side. And I can go through time. And it's like, what? This is, I think we kind of missed a few chapters in the physics book or something. Yep. And so I think this movie, again, setting the bar low for kind of future generations, has, this is not really science fiction, honestly, this movie. because it's not like Heinlein or something where like things are, we actually try to come up with something that is based in science,
right?
And, you know, come up with a hypothesis, or like as a movie example, like Interstellar.
Yeah.
That Christopher Nolan, for all his pretentiousness at times, you know, has really done some research to try to make the astrophysics of that make sense. This is more just like magic.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of time travel movies, I think, they're short on science. So, I mean, like, look at the time machine in this movie. I looked at my wife when we're watching this, and I was like, that looks like Santa's sleigh. And she said, I thought the same thing.
With an umbrella strapped to the back, yes.
Well, and it's just so ridiculous, man. Like, so I think it shows the, it's a visceral medium, right? You're supposed to see things. Okay, I get that. But on one hand, it's like, we want to see a time machine. On the other hand, it's like, why does it have a red light bulb on the back? Why is the red light bulb in a little cage?
Yeah.
And why, you know, it makes so little sense where he's like, here's my miniature. And if you push the lever up, bring, it's gone.
Yeah.
It's like, what, the lever? What the heck? What do you mean? You are a guy with a bunch of clocks in your house.
Yeah.
How did you freaking make this happen? You know? Yeah. So it's kind of ridiculous, and you definitely need to suspend your disbelief, honestly,
from moment one. Like, you get no, I was going to say, I wrote down when I was watching this, like, this is we'll get into it, right? But this is a movie that just looks so painfully set PC, right? Like,
yeah.
Everything looks so fake, and the matte paintings are obvious, but the time machine itself, as you were saying, like, it looks like a prop guy was like, I got a bunch of crap in the back, I'm just gonna nail it together. And that really goes for the whole production, I think, because like what I noticed off the bat, you know, you get this clocks in the intro sequence, but the score of this movie is so big for its britches. It's like,
oh my gosh,
it's wild. Like,
it's really bad.
Yeah. And it's working so hard at times to tell you something that's really not being told elsewhere.
And if I could go back just for a second, I'd be happy to continue talking about the score, but you mentioned the clocks in the beginning.
Yeah.
I tried to put that out of my mind as soon as like minute two or whatever of clocks passed. There's no credits rolling. There's no music. It's just like flying clocks. You
it's
know,
just
like
clocks.
The intro of the Twilight Zone, you have like one clock go by,
yeah.
Which is like, oh, that's kind of creepy. In this, there's like 4,500 conservatively.
Every clock that's ever been made is in this intro sequence.
It's a click, click, tick, 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 cuckoo, cuckoo, bing, bong, bing, bong. And it's all for nothing. It doesn't do, there's not like a voiceover coming about like time. You know, it doesn't happen. So yeah. I found that really superfluous and kind of distracting. How about you?
Oh, no question, my friend. And okay. I found most of the movies superfluous and distracting.
Okay.
But let's talk about someone, because we're going to get into the plot, which we can, I think, kind of bump along the plot on this one pretty swiftly. But Rod Taylor at the center, who I've already said, like, he's in one of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes. He's fan-freaking-tastic in that episode, as is everybody else. But this is a very odd match for his abilities in my mind. I think the script is pretty lackluster, so I'm not saying anybody could elevate this material, but there's a few things, right? Like, one, from a casting perspective, he just doesn't look like an inventor. Like, they've got like this period correct thing where they kept it in the same time frame as the novel, when they could have moved it up, you know, started it in 1960 and then moved. They could have done anything. Like, you have license to do anything with a story like this. And he just looks like he's plopped out of the 60s in this, you know, turn of the century outfit with his haircut and his jawline and everything.
Well, and doesn't that problem extend to the 800,000s AD where woman has 60s hair?
Oh, yeah. And we'll get into the hair. I want to spend 45 minutes talking about the hair. But aside from his look, he has a very shaky kind of comes in, comes out. Sometimes it's really heavy, and at other times, oddly enough, Justin, it sounds like an American dude trying to do a British accent, but he's not American.
Agreed. Right. He's Australian.
He's Australian. So I don't even, that's a neat trick to sound like from the outback, but you are sounding like an American dude. Because, I mean, like, I've seen that Twilight Zone episode. He sounds very American. He's very convincing. I would have never guessed that he was Australian. And in this, it sounds like, who would it be? It would be like Jimmy Stewart trying to do a British accent or something. Like,
right.
It's very weird. And more than that, I just don't think there's a lot of meat on the bone for the character. I mean, there, we'll talk about times where they kind of try to insert some theme with a line of dialogue here and there, but the characters in this movie are barely worth mentioning because they're all just like blocks of wood.
Yeah, but there is, at the same time, while we do have, you know, Doug Fir in one corner and some like white birch and some cedar, that the inventor does get to talk to as his friends. I do feel like, or I guess that's more in the future, because there is some potential with his friends in the past, right? Or in his present, whatever. Sure. Where it's like, you know, I did kind of buy the pretentiousness of the doctor, the actual true friend that, you know, this Philby guy was to him. And, you know, the other two, you know, there was just, but it was never milked for anything, right?
No.
It was just like, hey, I bet that cow's got some milk. Yep, I bet it does too. All right, let's go ride our bicycles. You know, like, it just was like, why can't we actually find out if there's any milk in there?
Milk,
I don't know.
That
kinda,
cow. Milk.
They needed
that
to
cow.
Milk that cow. That's going to be our campaign slogan.
That's it.
You know, when he goes, like, here's my, one of my problems with this movie. I guess I have many problems, as you do too. But when he starts going in the future, I found this movie to be so myopic for its own, like, the movie is so caught up in the 20th century.
Oh, yeah.
Which like, I get, right? And that would be fine if he only time travels to, like, the year 2000 or something, right? Then it's like, fine, whatever, stop off in World War II. But he stops in 1917.
Yeah.
I freaking don't know why, except that they want to talk about World War I. Obviously, that's not in the novella from 1895. It's not to me that it's just like a really dumb choice, because there, you could have spent a whole movie where he just walks around 1917 and is like, oh, crap, maybe I shouldn't go in the future at all, because I found out one of my friends is already dead.
Yep.
The world's at war. Like, forget it, man. This is not going to be exciting.
You could cut that entire sequence and the movie would be better for it. It's too long.
You could, I mean, because then he goes to 1940 and he's like, oh, my contraption's being shaken around a little bit.
Right.
And it's because he's in the Blitz, of course. London is being bombed by the old pesky Nazis. Why are we, like, this stuff is not far, like, because, you know, if you've read the book, he's going to go hundreds of thousands of years in the future.
Right.
So it's like, really, why is he stopping 20 years in the future?
Sure.
40 years? It just feels lame, frankly. It's lame. But lamest to me, Travis, lamest of all of this, because this isn't just story, this is production, is when he stops in 1966. And... and the like air raid is going off, right? Presumably because, oh my gosh, the bomb is going to kill us all. Which was a true, right? Even in the 80s.
Sure, absolutely.
People were freaking losing their minds. Red Dawn and you know, the day. It's not called The Day After Tomorrow. Do you know the movie I'm talking about, Travis? Made for TV.
Oh, gosh.
Reagan even watched this movie and it changed his mind on nuclear weapons. it's something like The Day After Tomorrow, but it's not that. Listeners, send your fan mail.
Yeah.
Or call us in, our live line, 555-something-3000.
That's it.
So I get that. I understand that's the moment we're in. I did think it was a little ridiculous that, like, only 6 years in the future from where this movie is made, the air raid warden is wearing, like, a spacesuit.
And
it was, like, a Power Ranger suit.
A very flattering metallic jumpsuit. It that is where the outer limits comes right to the surface, and you're like,
yes.
I'm sorry, what are you wearing? Like, this is bonkers.
Okay, so then we have, you know, everyone's like, he's like, get to the shelter, me laddie. I don't know why that was the voice he used, but it was, you know, go watch the movie.
He
and
stuck
tell
with
me
that
wrong.
Scottish accent all the,
yeah.
And look, if you're going to go with consistency, his Scottish was a lot better than Rod Taylor's British throughout, I will say.
No argument there. So, of course, what happens? I'm thinking, like, you know, it's just an air raid siren. We're just going to get a taste of, like, you know, hey, this is, you know, oh, we're getting the all clear. No big deal. Nope. It's actually freaking nuclear warfare, guys.
Yep.
But here's the thing. Here's the kicker. I don't know. You know, hey, Travis, maybe we should slow it down a little bit because apparently, like, what happens when a nuke drops? was kind of like maybe people forgot or they weren't really sure. Because
yes,
like Hiroshima,
because this had happened. It's not like we were just, you know, supposing what might happen. This had literally happened. We know what a nuclear bomb does.
But in this movie, it does something different. It does kind of magical things. Again, magic is kind of a theme in this movie.
Yes.
It explodes, yep, apparently like right next to him, because all the cars, which suddenly turn into a miniature set,
that,
and like, yeah, like you remember the, did you ever do the, in your school, Travis, in like elementary school, did you do like the volcano thing?
Oh yeah.
Where you like put the bait. Okay. Yeah. That's like what it was.
I think it literally was that. I mean.
And so for some reason, he's like, yes, he's not in the time machine at this point, folks. He's just out watching the world. Yep. And he's like, oh, they dropped the bomb, and then it exploded, and then guess what happened? Mother Nature erupted with volcanoes. And it's like, what? Volcanoes? And so there's just a close-up of a volcano,
yep,
but he's in London.
Yeah.
Where is the volcano? There's no volcanoes in London that I'm aware of.
No.
anyway, and so, like, it's exploding all around him. The world is coming to an end. And he's just like, ow, this is kind of loud. It makes my ears hurt. Let me get back to my time machine and escape. It's like, what? What? I'm sorry. You said a nuclear satellite, which I don't really even understand what that is. I mean, it's not explained. A nuclear satellite has exploded right over your face.
Yeah.
But he is able. Thank goodness he's such a stud. He makes it back to his time machine and goes on.
He's too hunky to get killed by the nuke. There's no question. Yeah, so... Let's talk about the effects for a moment, because, I mean, there's one thing worth mentioning, which is that this movie won a freaking Oscar for Best Visual Effects.
The times have changed.
Yeah. Look, a little latitude. I'll give it a little latitude, which is lots of things win the Best Oscar for Best Visual Effects, and then you might look at them a decade later and say, that was then, this is now, right?
You're talking about CGI face effects in the beginning. It's going to be the same.
I am. I literally am, because movies that we've seen post 2000 when Best Special Effects, you're going to look at them, you could look at them now and say like, what, you know? In this case, there's two distinct real like flexes in the special effects department, if you want to call them that. One is, I think, worth some credibility, which is there's some great stop motion and photography tricks used during the time travel sequences, right?
Yeah.
Like you see flowers blooming too fast. You see the sun moving across the horizon too fast. That stuff, I'm sure, in 1960 was like mind-blowing, really cool to see on a big screen.
Totally.
But, and maybe the miniature stuff was too, but, you know, we're looking at everything in hindsight now. And Justin, 10 years later, right? Like 10 years later, George Lucas changes the face of the blockbuster as we know it. And we have amazing miniature work, amazing matte painting work, and explosions and all these things from Star Wars. And this now just looks insane. Like you were saying, like the miniature work in this is so obvious. The magma and explosions, everything is so, it looks so tiny when they cut from a real person to that stop motion aside. I look at this Oscar now and I think like, what else was nominated that year? Anyway, let's keep moving through the plot as the time machine does move through time. Yes. Where we really land, that matters. You know, I think they try to draw out some of that character stuff with him and Philby in a way that it doesn't really hang together. It's just, there's not, if the whole story was about him and his friend as they move through time, that might be really interesting because again, people, we can relate to people. In this case, he gets to 8,000 something or other year.
800,000, Travis.
Oh, excuse me. I missed a couple zeros. anyway, way in the future, and this is where we settle, right? This is the sort of the future of the movie that matters most. There's a war alluded to between, quote, the East and the West. We have these people who, they're the Eloy people, and they all look the same. They're all of the same age. They look so similar that they all have the same haircut, which I don't understand. Men and women alike, almost. Like, they all have this weird blonde bob that it's a universal haircut. There's giant fruit. There's There's
biblical attire.
Biblical, yeah, like sackcloth and tunics, and and they all are extremely apathetic. They don't really care to ask questions or work or learn. And here's where the movie, you know, the most unrealized expectations exist in this section, right? Because he comes to this future to see what has man become. And there's a character that we're supposed to sort of become drawn to and attached to, like he does, who is named Weena. And the problem here in the movie is that nobody has any agency because they're designed that way. And he is sort of this frustrated, oh, what has happened to humanity? There's like an interesting line at some point where he's like, oh, you're not going to tell me about how things became the way they were. Show me your books. I want to see your books, right? He goes to their tiny little bookshelf library and the books just crumble in his hands. And he says, yes, they do tell me all about you, right? And it's like there's this tiny germ of something there.
Right.
But in general, this movie, which I'm sure the H.G. Wells novella does not fall victim to, it just devolves into this set piece disaster of the Eloi people versus the, here they come, Justin, the Morlocks.
The Morlocks.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
So they're being bred like cattle. Justin, talk to us about the Morlocks versus the Eloi, because that's the crux of
dear.
It.
It's not really even a versus.
Yeah.
Well, at least in the novel. I guess it's a little different in the movie. But the Morlocks have become these, like, monstrous, troglodytish, underground-dwelling things that I guess people evolved into.
Yeah.
They used to be, like, the working class. They were blue-collar, now they have blue skin. Because apparently if you live underground for 100,000 years, your skin's going to be blue and your eyes going to turn red. And you're going to get horrible body hair and all over.
Gingivitis. They're like Smurfs who don't have a healthcare plan. It's what it
right?
is.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's totally. And they have like meth mouth, all of them. So, hey, maybe that's what's keeping them alive. I don't know. But they apparently eat the Eloi. And the Eloi are just like, yeah, whatever. I guess that's cool because they're just apathetic.
Right.
Which works in the novel and doesn't really work as well in the movie. Because there's just, it makes little sense, right? Like when he tries to go recover his time machine and Weena's with him, one of the Morlocks like tries to capture her to take it to its cannibal dungeon or whatever.
Right.
But then later in the movie, they just send out like their air raid siren and they have this really awkward, all clear conversation.
Oh my gosh.
That's really bad.
That's unwatchable, man. I was sitting there with my fist in my mouth. Like, please let this end. He says all clear like a dozen times. I can't.
But all clear. It's all clear. They honestly hired some of the worst actors to play the Eloi. I don't know if that's a combination of worst actor and worst director.
And the writing's terrible. I mean,
it's bad.
Yeah.
What is, they don't say books because they do actually show them books, but
yeah.
He's like, what is your dilemma? Dilemma? What's dilemma? And it's like talking to a dog, you know? It's just like, what?
A dog with a bob. Yes.
Yeah, it's not good. But back to the good old Morlocks.
Yes.
They send out the air raid siren and the Eloi just line up to be eaten.
Yep.
So I don't know why they have to go out and kidnap them, except that they really wanted like the worst kind of jump scare. Because it's not scary.
Oh my gosh.
It's just a jump gotcha, I guess.
Yeah.
Where Weena's like, I'm going to sit here with my 60s hair. And then Morlock Smurf meth arms come out and grab her. And it's like, okay, that looks terrible. Oh, and speaking of the score, that's one of the worst offenders right there. Because it's like Morlocks.
It's insane.
Like,
yeah.
Please, stop.
The character of Weena to me was so hard to watch. Like, so hard to watch because
she's so good at acting.
Well, I don't even know. I could look up Yvette Mimieux, and maybe she has some fantastic credit that I don't know of. But the point of this conversation is, I can't, it's such a weird, like, character relationship because she's like, you know, I don't know, maybe 18, but also completely ignorant to the world around her. And he comes in and is just like a little bit smitten with her. And she's just so like, she's so in her state of like not knowing how the world works or not caring that like any advances that happen there are it's not like predatory, like in a super creepy way, but it is just uncomfy for me. I can't, because this is right. Like she's like a block of concrete, right? It's in the script. It's not her fault. She's also not bringing any charisma to it, maybe because she's not allowed to, but she has a line, right, that is just emblematic of it, which is, I do not understand you, but I believe you. And it's like, that's not a good place to be in as a person.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I think all the thematic stuff that they try to sort of jam in, you know, he says, the one characteristic which distinguishes man from the animal kingdom is the spirit of self-sacrifice. It's like, okay, in another movie, maybe that's interesting. But in this movie, like, you are not hitting at that batting average. It's not... It's a grand statement that never is earned. You know what I mean? This all comes to a head, Justin. I'm sorry. This all comes to a head in a Morlock fight underground.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, where we're going to see what are the Morlocks, what do they really look like? Because they've really been keeping them, you know, like all good horror directors, they keep their monster in the shadows and they don't show you too much. It's all about subtlety. Until you're in the underground dungeon and you just have freaking hundreds, seemingly. Really, there's only like 12 of them because they couldn't afford any more suits, I'm sure. Justin, would you like to speak for any length of time about how we see Morlocks in this movie meet their demise?
Let me count the ways, because Mortal Kombat's got nothing on some of the insanity in this movie. You've got Morlocks that move kind of like a goblin that, like, honestly has some kind of like intellectual disability and is also like disabled for another reason, like gangrene has set in or something. So they kind of hobble and sort of side to side. You're not really sure, do they bounce in their hips, in their shoulders, in their belly button? Where does it come from? And it doesn't really matter because they come at our inventor friend and at the Eloy, and they're like, that's the sounds they make. Yep. Apparently they have no language to communicate with either.
No, but the Eloy and conveniently speak almost perfectly English.
They speak English, which is not in the novel, believe it or not, because H.G. Wells somehow had the brain power to go, you know what? Since our language has changed so much over the 1,000 years that we could hardly understand that, probably 800,000 years in the future, ain't nobody going to understand anything. But no, in this movie, they're like, books? Yes. Did you want Shakespeare? Or, you know.
Yeah.
So, the Morlocks come out to do their attacking, and good grief. Good thing that our inventor friend, H. George Wells, has been working out.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he's been inventing so much as he has been shredding it at the gym.
He's been inventing new muscles on his body.
He invented CrossFit, I think. And so he just starts wailing on the Morlocks, who are like powerless to do anything most of the time. But then magical things also happen here, folks. The Morlocks like have a little bit of adrenaline going, so they're kind of, you know, kind of like Quasimodo. It's okay, settle down. But then all of a sudden, one of them like dive bombs, like WWF, goes up on a cliff and just boom, he tries to nail our inventor friend in the back.
Off the top rope, yes.
Where did that come from?
I don't know.
But here's what I love, right? The fatalities, right? We talked about watching Mortal Kombat, I think, last season. These are incredible fatalities,
incredible.
Right? I recall that George punches one of the Morlocks. The Morlock hits his head against a wall, and blood just squirts out of his face.
Yes.
Okay? But better than that is that some of them explode.
Oh, my gosh. I want to talk about exploding Morlocks for 14 episodes.
They explode.
They literally explode.
For no known reason.
No.
It must be similar to the magic that caused our inventor friend. You know what, Travis? It's probably because the nuclear satellite gave him some kind of power to make other things explode. So when he scissor kicked the Morlocks and brought them down like Bruce Lee, they just have no choice but to implode.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that was an acting choice, though, too. Maybe everyone was so embarrassed to be a part of this production. They were like, I'm out. And they chose the blue pill.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. So I think there's let's wrap this up because this is it, man. I mean, if we'll talk about it in the wrap up, but there's a very limited value in this in a movie like this, whether it's made in 1960 or today, which I think, and I'm just foreshadowing the end of this series. You know, Avengers Endgame. I think there are a this is a very different looking movie. Certainly, effects have come a long way, but they have their own sort of crutches. This is just pure popcorn junk.
Yeah.
Like anything that was in the H.G. Wells novel, there's just a hanging chad of it. You know, just a small vestige of theme. But I have one serious question, which is, Justin, don't you think that it's kind of poetic? It's kind of thematically poetic that, you know, we find H. George Wells in the beginning of the story. He's really distressed that the world is using science to destroy human life, that, you know, potential wars on the horizon that he sees are, you know, just distressing to him in his core, in his soul. And yet here we find him in the climax of the film, you know, waging a war of his own.
Do you mean opening a can of whoop ass? Because that's really, yeah. And you know, yeah, that's.
I tried. Yeah.
I guess you could try to make the movie doesn't deserve any kind of commentary about like, well, when pressed, it just does become survival of the fittest.
No.
And, you know, no. The movie's just like, want to watch Rod punch some people in suits?
Yep.
Come on down. All you need to see is the poster, poster for this movie, and you'll know I probably shouldn't watch that movie.
Yeah.
You know what is interesting, though, Travis, as we look ahead to the 50s, that being our next big decade series, I was interested to learn that some of the things from Forbidden Planet were reused for this movie.
Yes, the set pieces and props and stuff, yes.
So I don't want to make any promises to our listeners, but that may be something that gets brought up later in a season.
It might be fun to revisit a movie like this in the 50s and just see, hey, that's the metallic suit again. it's a mess at the end. There's tiny explosions of Morlock holes that are clearly tiny and not full scale. But Justin, not necessarily explosions, and I don't want to get too in the weeds here or potentially crude. But I do have a nutritional question.
Oh boy!
Which is, we see all of these Eloy people. They feed. I'm saying it like they're raptors, but they are their sustenance is purely giant Willy Wonka fruit. What do you think the situation is like the bathroom line? I mean, what is it like here?
Well, I think they had to cut that scene out for code reasons. I mean, you remember Steve Jobs? It didn't really go well for him.
Right.
So I'm going to guess the fruitarian thing. Actually, no one lives past maturity, because if the Morlocks don't take them, their large intestine does. Okay. I'm going to guess they're not doing any favors by having the mega-sized berry that our friend George is so enamored by, which is kind of awkward. Do you know how much a berry like this would cause a stir in my century?
A stir. He means an intestinal stir. Yes. Okay. We've had a mental intestinal stir from watching this film. Let's talk about if it's worth our time in a section we call Past, Present, and Future Value.
Obviously, the time continuum has been disrupted, creating this new temporal event sequence resulting in this alternate reality.
English, Doc.
If you travel to the past, that past becomes your future, and your former present becomes the past, which can't now be changed by your new future.
Exactly. Gentlemen, we're history.
All right, Justin, I'll let you kick it off. Is there any past, present, or future value? Is it worth anyone's time?
Oh, boy. I couldn't recommend this to watch to anybody, really. You know, the novella doesn't take very long to read. Again, it's 100 pages or less. So,
right.
If you're interested in that story, I commend H.G. Wells' work to you. I wouldn't commend this movie just because there's nothing... I mean, I guess it's better than beating your head against a CMU wall, but, you know, maybe just a little bit. I would advise listeners that are interested in this movie to first go fight a Morlock in the flesh by themselves so that they can relate to the main character a little more.
Yeah.
And then have something to hold on to when they watch the movie. For me, there's not really any value here, except... I mean, I'm trying to be generous here, but I guess from, you know, like a historical movie perspective, it is interesting to see, like, wow. Like you mentioned earlier with special effects, wow. In 1960, we thought this was the cat's pajamas.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. But today, the cat is wearing an Iron Man suit.
Yeah, that's
it. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of all I can say. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. This is bad. I think I may be a little bit more in this boat of bad can be really good and fun at times. But something we did not really mention in the whole lessons in light speed was this thing's boring. Like it's
dry. It's not fun.
No, it's like eating a ream of saltine crackers without any glass of water. So
sign me up.
If only for the reason that you maybe have a special group of pals that you like to watch bad stuff with, this may have some merit on that front only, because it's just, you know, the Morlock fights and that kind of stuff are, I think, are really good fun. Like when you get into the third act, there's a lot of schlocky fun stuff, but there's a huge hour in the middle there where he's, like you said, making pit stops through the ages that are, oh man, they're not interesting. There's only one piece of like time travel logic in here that I think we might see in future films in this series, which is the idea of the future is set. Can man control his own destiny? Right. And it's just a tiny little nugget that they don't really do anything with. And I think I hope to see that realized in a more interesting way. It's really not worth your time unless you're watching it ironically, honestly.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll ever watch this again unless I want to just show someone the Morlock scene, in which case it's going to be, you know, bookmarked on my Google Chrome forever. Oh, Justin, we escaped the Morlocks. Just barely.
Hallelujah.
By the skin of our beautiful hunky teeth.
In our fists.
In our fists. Our double axe handle maneuvers. Next week, we're going to see another hunk who played Superman in a movie from 1980 called Somewhere in Time. I have not seen this, and I think you have at some point, right, Justin?
Yes. Very excited, and maybe kind of a sick way to revisit. Should
okay.
be fun.
Yeah. Looking forward to the soft focus goodness of this love story. We'll see you next week for that episode. Bye.
See ya.
Let the movie speak!
Hey, since you're still here and still listening, thank you, by the way, we'd like to ask an additional favor of you.
We have social media. It's a thing on the internet, and all you need to do is find us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and like and subscribe. I know this is annoying, but we have to ask you because we want more people to hear the show. In addition to that, if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we would greatly appreciate it. See you next week. Bye.